For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, good evening everyone. Welcome back. Always nice to see everyone. Okay, Hanukkah is coming. Quick show of hands. To next Monday night, Birtz Hashem, we will be in the very tail end of Hanukkah, the second to last night of Hanukkah. We have a class scheduled as far as the official printout goes, but it's the middle of Hanukkah, so I don't know whether or not that's going to impact anybody. Quick show of hands of those who would still like to have a regular class next Monday night for Hanukkah. Okay, so we'll do a regular class, and if those of you can't make it, it's fine. Everything will be recorded, and you'll have a chance to look at it, listen to it later. Well, I bring donuts. If you're sponsoring donuts, I'll bring them. Okay, that was a yes? All right, we have donuts sponsored next week. For those of you who did not raise your hand for the first go-around, that you were not planning on coming, if you come now, I won't make fun of you. But we will have donuts. Thank you, Harry Robin. Tonight's donuts were sponsored by Judy Garber in commemoration of the art set of her father, Isidore Wolper, Yisrael Ben Yaakov. Thank you very much, Judy, for sponsoring tonight's class. And if anyone would like to sponsor any of these individual classes, please see me or Gail in the office, and we will be happy to do so and provide everybody with an opportunity to make a bracha in their honor and in their merit. Okay, so let's begin talking a little bit about Hanukkah as tomorrow night. First candles will be lit by this time, Mirtz Hashem, tomorrow night. So as I'd like to start off with a thought-provoking question, we will do so this evening as well. I guess we can do a show of hands. By a show of hands, do you believe in miracles?
Yeah.
You guys are a good Jewish Orthodox group of people. I really appreciate that. Okay, so let's go home. Okay, so you all believe in miracles. So that means you have your eyes open to the world. As believing Jews, we believe in miracles. That's excellent. How about this question? Do you believe because of miracles? I'm not asking if you believe in miracles. I want to know if you believe because of miracles. Is the source of your belief system because of miracles, either past or present, that it's because of miracles that your belief system is rooted in what it is? Or if I would ask, let's say, we've mentioned many times, emuna, belief, faith, is really not a yes or no question. It's a spectrum. Everybody's on the spectrum somewhere, in the same way as being a person of kindness is not a yes or no, I am kind, I'm not kind. That's not true. Either the spectrum. I'm this kind on this day, and I'm more kind to these people, and I'm always growing in that. So emunah is the same way. It's a spectrum. If I were to come in here and perform a miracle, and with a snap of my finger, because I established myself as a prophet, and with a snap of my fingers, you each got a whole jelly donut in front of you right now. Poof. Not cut up into fourths. Whole jelly donut. Right there. And I did it, and you're like, wow, and you ate it, and it was real. And I said, that's because Hashem did that, not me. And I performed that miracle, even if I was just a prophet and I declared that Hashem would do that. Would you believe more after seeing or experiencing that than you did before seeing and experiencing that? Would that impact your belief system in the Creator of the universe because you literally experienced a miracle?
Yes.
We'll get to that. Yeah, that would be a miracle, meaning like all of a sudden like a jelly donut appeared in front of you. Like, however we'll define it, like that would be it. What's that? I would be a believer. If I could produce a jelly donut that didn't have any calories, then for sure I'd be a believer. So the question that we'll address tonight is, what's the role of miracles? Where do miracles fit into the Jewish system? Because they're clearly a part of it. They exist. There's no denying that miracles, they're with us from the beginning, and they continue until today. And the question is, how do we address them, and where do they necessarily fit into our worldview, so to speak. So to begin the discussion, what would life be like if there were open miracles everywhere, every day? Like literally, that's all a person saw. So if, for those of you who believed that your life would change if I was able to perform a miracle, if I was able to suddenly make jelly donuts appear and it was real, and I forget me making it, God did that. And you saw and attributed it to God easily, clearly, and our whole lives were that way. So do you think we would be different? Do you think we would function or live our lives differently?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, but we don't view that as... We'll talk about that. It's going to get to... A miracle is clearly going to... We're going to get to the definition in a moment. Is a change or a shift from that which is normal. So we find that... Let me just say a couple things, and it could be that you have a lot of questions because there's a lot to talk about, and I haven't gotten to any of it yet, so things are unclear. And they'll probably be unclear when I'm finished too, but at least then I'll take your questions. So the starting point of the discussion is really rooted in a Ramban, a comment that the Ramban Nachmanides makes in the very beginning of the Chumash, in the very, very, very beginning. He sets the tone for that which we experience regularly, and he does it from the following question that he asks. In the very second parsha of the Chumash is the parsha of Noah. And Noah is commanded to build an ark that's going to save mankind, that's going to save him and his family and all the animals of the world. And he builds a large ark. How long does it take him to build this ark? 120 years of building. It's really pretty enormous. It's even bigger than this shul, the ark that he builds. 120 years of effort going into. And the Ramban asks a very simple question. He says, that's really nice that he spent a long time building it. He could have built it for as long as he wanted to. Do you think he could have built an ark large enough to hold all the animals of the world? And the Ramban takes the approach, the answer is no. No way. You can build a structure that's going to float on water and that's going to be large enough that's going to hold all the animals of the world. It's absurd to think all this. It's crazy. So how did that happen, says Ravon? How did all these animals get into this ark? So he says it was a miracle. It was a miracle that you sat there watching, like the clown cars. You just watched it by two, by two, by two, by seven, and they would just keep going up the ramp, and somehow they all ended up in this ark. Which, the dimensions we have, as enormous as it was, and as long as it took him to build, we have the dimensions. It's a big cruise liner. But if you just watched for hours and hours and hours of being loaded, it didn't make any sense. Ravon says it was a miracle. It was a miracle. And then Ravon asks a follow-up question. He says, well, if it was a miracle that you got all the animals onto this ark, however large it was, 200 amos by 300 amos by 50 amos, it's a big ark, but it's still a miracle. It's still logically, they don't fit. So then why build it so big? Why did he have to spend so much time building such a large ark, since anyway, there's no way you can get all the animals in? So one of the answers that he gives, which you might be familiar with, is that he wanted Noah to be busy with it so that people should see, and they should ask him, and maybe they'll come to do tshuva, they'll come to recognize that the world is going to be destroyed. That's one answer he gives. Then he gives a second answer. He says a very simple answer, which he sets the tone for the entire Chumash, which is, because God does everything in His power, I shouldn't say it that way, that doesn't make sense, God does everything possible to minimize the miraculous in the world. Does whatever you can do so that it will look and appear as natural as possible. So therefore, he built a large ark so that when you're watching the animals go in, if you were to just watch for a snippet of 5 minutes, 10 minutes, even a half hour, that looks normal. If you were to watch the whole time, you would say, "That, wait a minute, it's impossible." But at any given time, this makes sense. This looks normal. And since it looks normal, if I built a little rowboat and we said, okay, all the animals get in, that is from the very get-go, it doesn't make any sense. It's impossible. It's the same miracle, 200 animals by 300 animals by 50 animals can't hold all the animals of the world anyway. But that looks okay at any given time. And that's how God runs the world. And there are numerous other examples throughout Tanakh throughout the Navi, throughout the Chumash, in which things are done when the sea split and the Jews cross through. What does the Torah say right before the sea split? There was a huge wind which came in from the east and the sea split. So you have this massive miracle. And how is it performed? What splits the water? All movies aside. There's this huge wind that comes and the water splits. That's how the Torah itself describes how the miracle took place. Because whatever can be done to minimize miracles is what's done. That's on the one hand. Why is it done that way? On the simplest level, because of the concept called free will. That concept, which is going to be an entire class we'll have, God willing, within this class of essentials. But just while standing on one foot, the pillar of everything that we do, that we live for, is because we have what we call free will to choose to live the way we decide to live. And in order for there to be free will, in order for there to be the choice between right and between wrong, between that which is moral and that which is immoral, between that which is correct behavior and incorrect behavior, it has to be that we are the ones making that choice. And if there would be this obvious hand of God in everything that we did, we would lose that ability to a great extent. And therefore, to maintain a concept of our own free will, many of the commentators point out, that's what's driving this comment from the Ramban, from Nachmanides, that the world runs in a way in which miracles are hidden. That's point number one, we'll put it on the table. Let's contrast that with the Pesach story, the Exodus from Egypt. What is the Exodus from Egypt all about? It's all about miracles. Open miracles. Plagues, seas being split, manna falling from heaven, wells miraculously traveling with the Jewish people in the desert. One step after another, every single thing of the Exodus story is about the open miracle. And the Torah is very explicit why. Why are there so many miracles throughout the story of the Exodus? It's for one major reason, and that is Leman teidu ki ani Hashem v'kerev haaretz, that you should know I am God. How do we know that there is a God? So the Torah says, I asked it as a question. How many of you believe in miracles? You all are pretty clear about that. How many of you believe because of miracles? So, well, the Torah says, yeah, that's what you should believe. I proved to you that I am the creator of heaven and earth. And if you have any doubts, watch me do. Because I'm going to take everything you know and flip it on its head. And if you had any doubts, this story will make it clear to you otherwise. Now that you know it, celebrate Pesach every year, tell over that story to you, to your children, to your grandchildren, make sure that story is kept in our minds always, Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, we say it numerous times, over and over and over, daily. Remember the Exodus, remember the Exodus. What are we remembering? That's our source, that God in fact came and in an open way revealed, because He's not going to do that in every generation. But He did it to our father's 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 generation, and then we will tell that story over and over and over again to remind us. And these are actually two contrasting concepts which we live with regularly. On the one hand, we're going to live in a world that looks pretty normal. And it's going to function in a pretty normal way regularly, in which miracles are minimized. And on the other hand, we have an event which we recall daily and have an entire yontiv about. That's all about the open miracle, the concept, the fact that Hashem revealed Himself in an open way for the express written purpose of know me, recognize me, see me, and believe in me. Once you have that, then it's going to be normal. Going to be pretty normal, but the purpose of the revealed miracle is to come and learn something. So far, so good? Where does the Hanukkah story fit into this equation? Into that idea, that way of setting up the system as our sages basically set it up? Where is the Hanukkah miracle? Is it a minimizing the miracle kind of story? No, not really. It's pretty obvious. You take a little flask of oil and it burns for 8 days. Anybody there would have scratched their head and said, that's not normal. That shouldn't have happened. So it's certainly not in that. Is it there to teach us about God, that He exists? So we could say, sort of yes, sort of no. So what we're going to talk about tonight, Mirz Hashem, will be putting the context of this Hanukkah miracle, miracles really, into this bigger context of where we're supposed to put it, what we're supposed to do with it, and how we're supposed to come out of this Yontif with. So let's do that a little bit. Let's start with our Hanukkah story. What is the most obvious miracle that we celebrate on Hanukkah? The oil, which you're all familiar with. That story, if you want to just read it inside for a second, on page 7 on the sheets in front of you, on the top of page 7, we have here the actual Gemara, which records for us the Yontif of Hanukkah. We'll read it very quickly together. Many of you have seen this probably before. The Gemara asks, "My Hanukkah, what is this? What is this concept of Hanukkah?" So the Gemara actually records that when the Greeks entered into the holy sanctuary, they defiled all the oil that was there. Now the Gemara records, I'm going to get back to this in a moment, it sounds like it was a purposeful defilement, that the Greeks came and it didn't just happen to be that the oil became defiled when the Greeks overran the temple, but that the Greeks came in and went to defile the oil. And when the dynasty of the Chashmonaim grew strong and they were able to defeat them, they searched and found only one flask of oil with the stamp of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. That's all that they could find that had been set aside, and there was only enough oil to burn for one day. And the Gemara records a miracle occurred, and they lit the menorah from this oil for 8 days. And then the following year, the sages established these days for praise and for thanks, the Hallel Ulohodot, as we sing Hallel specifically on Hanukkah all 8 days in commemoration of this miracle that the one flask of oil burned for 8 days. You guys have heard of this story before? Why 8 days, by the way? Why not 9 days or 10 days or 11 days? Why did the oil last only for 8 days? So there are two reasons given. So one reason is that the oil presses, this is, I believe, the Ran on the bottom of your page expresses, this is one of the early commentators, the early Rishonim writes, that the oil presses were actually 4 days' journey away. So it took 8 days for them to dispatch the Jews to wherever it was where the oil presses were, and they were able to press the oil and then come back, and that's why it had to last for 8 days, because that's the amount of time that they needed. There's a second opinion, which is quoted right above that, which is that there was a war that just took place, and there's a general assumption that you have when people are involved in war that there are going to be dead bodies lying around, because that's the unfortunate consequence of war. And when you come into contact with a corpse, so that produces a certain type of tum of ritual impurity, which lasts 7 days. So that when they lit the menorah, they needed a full 8 days worth in order to be able to get everything done, and then they have to wait the 7 days, then they have to go to the mikvah, and then they were able to produce the oil that would be pure and not ritually defiled by the tumah created by all of these dead soldiers, and therefore that's why the miracle had to last 8 days. Okay, those are the two reasons given why it needed to be 8 days. We will get back to it. So be that as it may, so we have this miracle of the oil, and that's what we celebrate year in and year out with the lighting of our menorah, to recognize this particular miracle which took place. So far, so good? In davening, you're familiar with, we add on Hanukkah the Al Hanisim. Al Hanisim, the Al HaPorkon, it's added in Shemona Esrei, it's added in benching during Hanukkah. It's on the other side of your page, on page 6, page earlier. We'll read it together, and you will ask the question on your own after reading through this. Now, Al Hanisim, where is Al Hanisim said in davening? At which point of the Shemona Esrei? Which bracha, in the middle of which blessing is it inserted? Modim, the bracha of giving thanks. So here we're giving thanks, Al Hanisim, for the miracles which took place. Now, based on the Gemara, which you just said, we just read a passage from the Gemara just a moment ago. What was the miracle that the sages established Hanukkah on account of? The oil. They came in, there was no oil, they found one little flask, it lasted for 8 days. The next year, the sages established it as a yontif to halal lahodos, to give praise and to give thanks. So now we're going to give thanks. So what should we give thanks for? Thanks for all the miracles that took place. So we read Al Hanisim, in the days of Matisyahu, the son of the high priest, the Chashmonoi, and his sons, when the evil Greek kingdom rose up against your nation to make them forget your Torah and to turn them away from the statutes of your will. That was the time period that we were in. We'll talk about this in a moment. How the Greeks came in, they tried to remove all the Jews from their Torah observance. You and your abundant mercy stood by them in their time of distress. And so we give thanks to you, Hashem, when the Jews were distressed, when they were being attacked and they were being pushed out of their observance, you came and stood by them, you defended their cause, you judged their grievances. You have You avenged their cause. You delivered the strong into the hands of the weak, the many into the hands of the few, the impure into the hands of the pure, the wicked into the hands of the diligent students of your Torah. So we lift what a bizarre war this was, and a miraculous war that it was, that you delivered the many into the hands of the few. You made yourself a great and sanctified name in your world, and for your people Israel, you performed a great deliverance and redemption until this very day. Afterwards, your sons entered into the Holy of Holies in your abode. They cleaned your temple, purified your sanctuary, kindled lights in your holy courtyards, designated these 8 days of Hanukkah to thank and praise your great name. Before we ask the obvious question, which you're all thinking, just to put this in context, if you flip back one more page, I know it seems like we're going backwards, I know. Sort of like Jewish history. If you go back to page 5, So the curriculum that we have in front of us gave us a little passage from Rabbi Beryl Wine. So I figure, what's the class without me quoting from Rabbi Beryl Wine? So he gives us a little bit of a historical background of this war, just to give some of the numbers, because of what we just read. We gave thanks that you delivered the many into the hands of the few. Well, it's nice to read it every year, but what does it actually mean? So he describes that in about the year 166 BCE, a group finally stood up to the Greeks. Now the Greeks had already overrun the country for a couple of years, and they had thrown the Jews out of the Beis HaMikdash, they had defiled it, they were bringing non-kosher sacrifices, non-kosher animals and sacrifices in there, and had enacted all of the decrees from which we celebrate Hanukkah: no Shabbos, no learning Torah, no Rosh Chodesh. There were certain things that the Jews were simply not permitted to fulfill. There was a small group of Kohanim in Modin, about 12 miles northwest from Yerushalayim, and one day a Greek contingent marched into the Beit HaMikdash, into the Holy Temple. They set up an altar, they gathered all the Jews and forced them to sacrifice a non-kosher animal to Zeus. And then they asked for a Jewish volunteer to perform the sacrifice. And one Jew stepped forward to do it, to offer this non-kosher animal. At which point, as he approached the altar, Matisyahu stabbed him to death. And chaos broke out in the Holy Temple. The Greek army attempted to subdue the crowd. The Jews were armed and defeated the Greek patrol. And then they fled to the mountains, hid in the caves of around the area of Modin, and organized an army. Now, they were not able to fight in open war because they were not trained as soldiers. They were a bunch of farmers and scholars. And they didn't have a tremendous amount of arms, or they just weren't an army. So they fought, I don't know if it was the first guerrilla war ever fought, but that's what they fought. Originally a force of 3,000, eventually to 6,000, never reached more than 12,000 men. And an enormous, highly trained Syrian Greek army numbering almost 50,000 men with a herd of elephants marched into Judea, and Judah the Maccabee marshaled his forces with guile and courage, outmaneuvered the far larger Greek army, forced it to divide, and destroyed its various components, killing many thousands and forcing the survivors to flee north to Syria. This battle took, if you read the final paragraph, it describes the last battle. And when the last area, the fortress of Antoninus, fell, the Jews came back to the temple. It took 25 years of fighting and a great many casualties on both sides until the Seleucid Greeks finally reached a peace agreement with the Jews. 25 years of fighting. Now the numbers, if you go through, I actually had a couple of videos that, I didn't have the apparatus set up to show you, but there's some, one video that I saw today has a beautiful contrast of this Greek story with the 1967 war in Eretz Yisrael, in which you start comparing and contrasting the numbers. What were the numbers of Greek soldiers in contrast to the Jewish soldiers who were fighting? What's your percentage? What are you up against? What are you up against as far as spears versus elephants? Versus what were we up against just a few years ago in 1967 when you compare the numbers of the five armies on the border of Eretz Yisrael, when you compare the numbers of tanks, when you compare the numbers of planes, when you compare the numbers of ammunition, what were you fighting? And the numbers are actually eerily similar in terms of when you look at an outnumbered few fighting the many. The difference was in the Hanukkah story, we weren't even trained. Wasn't even an official army. But you read through those numbers, when we say the Al HaNisim, so what are we expressing our thanks for? What is it when we say the Modim, we're in the middle of giving thanks to Hashem for Hanukkah, what do we say thank you for? the survival, the miracle of the war. You handed over the many into the hands of the few. You handed over the well-trained into the hands of the scholars and the farmers, the impure into the hands of the pure. And we recognize that you did that and we give thanks. What's missing from Al Hanisim? Because it's not there. It's simply not there. So that if you were to ask somebody on the street and say, why do we celebrate Hanukkah? They'll say, well, because everybody knows the story. We found a flask of oil. There was only one. It should have only lasted one day. It lasted eight. So we have the Yom of Hanukkah. Great. Except that's not what the sages told us to do. When they told us why we celebrate Hanukkah, even though the Gemara says over that story. Yet, when we actually give thanks for the miracle, what miracle are we giving thanks for? It's totally about the survival. It's totally about the war. It has nothing to do. Nothing. We don't even mention it. If you notice at the very end, we mention oil, kindling lights, but not in the context of the miracle. We say, when the Jews defeated the Greeks, they finally came back to the temple, they relit the menorah, and they cleaned the place up, and everything was great. But not even a hint of the concept of the oil. Why is it missing in the place in which we give thanks? And here is a fundamental concept of the way that we deal with miracles, which is the embodiment of the entire holiday of Hanukkah, because there are two clear miracles which are described that we're celebrating. We have the miracle of the oil, that's clear, and we have the miracle of the war. What we do in practice is all about the oil. Everybody runs around, you gotta have menorah, and you buy your oil, and you line it. It's the practice, physically, what do we do? All about the oil. But when you think about what we're then giving thanks for, the words we use are not at all about that. It's all about the war. So this was not lost on our commentator. So just to read we'll keep it short and then we'll talk about it outside. If you look at the Maharal's comment on this, if you look on page 8, finally we're going to move forward. The Maharal says as follows, on the bottom of page 8, number 1 on there in the bottom. The essence of the establishment of the festival of Hanukkah was the military defeat of the Greeks. That's the essence of the reason why we have this Yontif. And that is, it's a simple sentence, but for many of us we have to like reread that and say, well, no, wait a minute, I always thought the miracle was about the candles. It's about the oil. That's what we know from childhood. Because if you'd come on Thursday morning when our preschool puts on their Hanukkah play, they're going to talk a lot more about oil and the menorah than they're going to talk about Jews going to war for 25 years and killing Greek soldiers. It just is. And that takes us through, they just expect that perpetuates itself. But what's the essence, says the morale of this Yontif? The essence of this Yontif is the war. Except that it was not apparent to them that this victory was a miracle. That line, says the Maharal, is our life. They experienced a miracle. Now, I wasn't around, I know this is going to sound shocking, I wasn't around in 1967. Wasn't even born yet. So I don't even remember it. I know. My parents weren't even married yet in 1967. But I have heard from many, if you lived through it, so at some point you're like, wow, that was crazy. And then you just, like, it's just another chapter in Jewish history. Even though if you would stop and think about, well, wait a minute, what just took place? That didn't make any sense. That's beyond, I don't know if this is true or not, but it's one of those things that everybody likes to say, that in West Point, when they teach military history, so they don't teach anything about the Israeli wars. They don't teach about 67, they don't teach about 73, they just don't teach it. And the rumor is, with true or not, I don't know, but it certainly, it could be true. As Rabbi Beryl Wine likes to say, I'll quote him again, I don't know if this is actually true or not, but it should be true. The answer is because there's nothing that the U.S. Army can learn from any of the Israeli wars, because none of it makes any sense. It's not like studying military history. Well, if they did this, well, then we could do it. No. Just because they did it doesn't mean it's going to transfer to anything. Because you have five armies who all are ready to invade at one time, and in one fell swoop, you take out the entire Air Force. in the early morning of June in 1967. And if you read through, look on the internet, there's so much information about all the things that went into that, the perfect timing and the weather conditions and the, when you combine that, but where do you get lost? Because if you watch the documentaries, so they'll tell you, so the Israeli army, this is what I've seen. They train how fast they could turn around this order, so that they, how many different missions can a single plane fly. So they had been the tops in the world of being able to have a plane go out on a mission, come back, be refueled, reloaded, and go out again. Whereas most armies were able to fly whatever it was, four or five in a day. The Israeli army had gone to where each plane can fly 15 or 16, far beyond the norm. They had done such research into the Egyptian Air Force that they knew exactly when they changed their guard from the breakfast shift to the dinner, to the early morning, to the late morning. So they knew exactly when there'd be the most pilots on the ground and not actually in their planes. They knew exactly which planes were the ones ready to be loaded and take off. They had all that information. So someone could look at that first several hours and say, why did the Israeli army score such a decisive victory in 1967? And they would say, because, and then they would point to all the things that the Israeli army did right, the information that they knew that led them to be able to annihilate their opponent's air force, and then once they knocked out their air force, so then they had free reign in the skies all around. Was that a miracle? Well, if you try looking at it like that, you could say, I don't know, not necessarily. Yeah.
CNN wasn't there.
And if they were there, they for sure wouldn't have said it wasn't a miracle. They would have said the atrocities, it was a disproportionate response, all they did was threaten the Jews, and look what they did to their air force. They probably did say that. But, so says the Maral, the Jews experienced that during the Hanukkah story. They waged a 25-year guerrilla war against the Greek opponents who had taken over their land. And after 25 years of slow attacks, chipping away here, knocking this down, taking over this fort, after 25 years, they made it back to the temple. Miraculous or military? What's the source of their success? Says the Maral, they could have looked at it and did look at it as not so miraculous, as a testimony to their strength, as a testimony to their planning, to their guile. Look at what we were able to accomplish. Therefore, says the Maharal, the miracle of the lights of the menorah was performed for them so that they would know that everything was a miracle from God. Blessed is He. So that when they came into the temple and they relight the menorah, staring them in the face is a miracle, which actually didn't have to happen at all. And that's another one of the major components of this yantiv. When you have certain miracles, this particular miracle, you say, did we need this miracle or not? Simple question, do we need this miracle? So on two levels, we didn't need it at all. Number one, how many years have the temple gone without having had the menorah lit at this point? It's a long time. Well, what's another 8 days in the scheme of a long time? So let's say they didn't have this miracle. They lit it for one day, and then it wasn't lit for the next couple of days. Nishka Feralach, as they say. But more than that, there's a halacha, there's an important halacha, that generally you're not allowed to light defiled oil, and you're not allowed to light in a state of defilement. Those are two things that are prohibited for the Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash. They can't be in a state of Tumah, they can't be in a state of ritual impurity, and you can't light with such oil. But there's an important halacha known as Tumah Chutra V'tzibur. There's a loophole, so to speak, an exemption, that if the entire congregation is impure, then that rule doesn't apply. It doesn't apply. It simply doesn't apply. You're allowed to be in the temple. The oil was allowed to have been lit if it was impure, because everybody was impure. And that's the halacha. That's not a Hanukkah law. That's a 365-day-a-year law. If everybody's impure, you're allowed to deal with impurity in the temple when it comes to certainly the menorah. Which means they had plenty of oil around. They were only lacking pure oil. Guess what the Jews of the Hanukkah story did not need? They didn't need pure oil. So not only do we have this miracle, But the miracle was completely unnecessary. Because do you know what they would have done after the first day? They found one. Great, let's do it ideally. Great, we found one flask. They would have poured it in, and the next morning, what were they expecting? That it would have burnt out. And then what were they planning on doing? Using impure oil. That was the plan. If you ever heard the question, well, why did they even bother lighting it? That's why. Because they were going to light it, and then it was going to burn out after a day, and then they were going to use impure oil because you were allowed to. And they get there the next morning, and it's still going. So it's an unnecessary miracle. Why? Says Morel, it was a sign to them. It was recognize something just happened. Because you might have otherwise just missed what's the actual main story here. The main story was a long war that took 25 years to fulfill, to finally run its course, and bring you to where you are right now. And over the course of those 25 years, you had many setbacks. You lost many casualties, many Jewish bereaved families over a long period of time. And you might say, wars take a long time. Someone's got to win. We threw the people who overtook us out. We took over our land again, just like every other country sometimes does. Except nothing is like any other country when it comes to the Jewish people. And the idea of a miracle also is not. Let's go back to what we started from. What's the definition of a miracle? Put it in this context. What is it? What's a miracle? What is a miracle? So in the beginning of your pages, I think there's one definition that they give you here from... Page 2, right? Yeah, the very first thing on the very first sheet, first line. A miracle, this is from the Thorndike Barnhart Dictionary, a wonderful happening that is contrary to or independent of the known laws of nature. So if it goes against the laws of nature, that's a miracle. Merriam-Webster defines it a little bit differently. Merriam-Webster defines a miracle as an extraordinary occurrence that surpasses all known human powers and natural forces, and is therefore ascribed to a divine or supernatural cause, especially to God. So a miracle is something which can't be explained. It's something which goes against or above all known natural things that you can explain. When you can't explain it through the natural laws, then it becomes a miracle. The lighting of the candle is a miracle because it doesn't fit. We know the natural laws are oil, this amount of oil only burns for one day. If it burns for 8, that's a miracle. It's something inexplicable. And it's there to teach us about the war, which you could have interpreted as being normal, that you should recognize that as a miracle as well. Because, and I now share with you a Ramban, and I'm sorry for jumping all over the place, but if you look at page 10, you will find a comment from the Ramban. And the Ramban writes, from the great and obvious miracles, one comes to appreciate the hidden miracles. There are those miracles which we would define as great and obvious, that goes against the laws of nature. And that really is only there to instruct us about the hidden miracle. The miracle which is taking place, but it looks normal. It's what we naturally would call nature. This is normal. I don't see any miracle in here. I just see this is the way the world works. But that's also completely miraculous. And says the Ramban, the purpose of the revealed miracles is to give you an insight into the things which you see in front of you. The purpose of the open miracles, that which is a total shift and change from the natural order, is to reveal that natural order also is miraculous. In the same way as the laws of nature, one could say, the laws of nature, it's just the way that it is. So the reason why God reveals Himself and changes those laws of nature every once in a while, in the most obvious way, in the Pesach story and the rest of the world minimizing that, are the reminders to us that those too are miraculous events. And that the same way that the Gemara records the story of one of the sages who didn't have any oil to light. So he told his daughter to take the vinegar and light that for her Shabbos candles. When she didn't have enough money for it, she says, light the vinegar. She says, the vinegar doesn't light, Abba. And his line, which is the title, so to speak, of our entire Hanukkah story, he who said that oil should light can say that vinegar can light too. Because there's really no difference between the laws of nature and what we call in our vernacular a miracle, other than the fact that we're used to the laws of nature. We experience them all the time. But if we, and therefore we can add, we can explain them. And since we can explain them, we take them out of the realm. That's not miraculous. I can explain that. It's only the things that I can't explain that I then define as a miracle. And one of the lessons of the Hanukkah story is we celebrate the oil. That's what we do. We get our hands busy with the oil, even though that's not really what the Yontif is about at all. The Yontif is about giving thanks to the war. Except we would have missed it. We would have let it go right by. And we just would have chalked it up to good planning and military tactics. And the miracle of the oil is a reminder something special happened here. Open up your eyes and see that which you might be able to explain, but you have to see that as a miracle also. You have to see that as the hand of Hashem directing events. One more train of thought, I'll put this all together. Why specifically the oil, and why specifically the menorah? Meaning that's the miracle that took place. But as we said, it wasn't even necessary. It's only there to draw our attention to something. But as in all things, nothing is by chance. Nothing is by chance. Let's take one step back. What was the entire battle of the Greeks and the Jews about? The Hanukkah story.
They wanted to assimilate
to what? What was the Greek philosophy about that they wanted the Jew to assimilate into? So I'm sure you're all saying the right things, but I can't make out all the different things that you're saying. So let's do one quick summary. Have it in your sheet on page 3. Now there is a lot of talk about this. This is just a summary from Reb Chaim Freelander. Reb Chaim Freelander lived in the last 50, 75 years in Eretz Yisrael. And he writes as follows. Page 3, number 1. The outlook of the Greek thinkers was in opposition to the teaching of the Torah. The Greek position is that the world always existed and God did not create the universe from absolute nothingness. And he has no ability to change anything in the world. According to them, the world always was, is, and will be, for it always existed and is not susceptible to change. It's one tenet of their philosophy, that there wasn't a creator. That the world as we see it always was. Now the ramification of that, the fact that we believe in a creator, what flows, and we're familiar with it, and we assume that everybody thinks that way, but it's not really true. If there was a creator, then that creator can manipulate that which he created. If the world always existed, it just always was, well then it always is, was, will be, and there is no being that can manipulate it because it always was there. And from this they derived another principle of the Greeks, that the forces of nature rule the world. When the Ramban Nachmanides discusses it, he puts it in the context of the Greek philosophers, if you can see it and prove it, it exists. If you can't see it or prove it, then I don't believe in it. It's a philosophical tenet. Prove it to me. And if show it to me. We have this today in the world of science and religion. And a purely scientific mind also functions in that way. And that's perfect for the world of science. I don't have any problem with that. You want to understand something? Show it to me. Prove it to me. Replicate it. But the world of religion doesn't work that way. And if you're creating an outlook in life and it's based on a scientific approach, which was the Greek philosophical approach of, if you can't show it to me or prove it to me, then I don't believe that it exists. Therefore, all circumstances and events throughout a person's life are not in compensation for any good or bad action, meaning they deny the principle of schar va'onish, reward and punishment, that your actions actually make a difference. They are the consequences of totally random acts of nature.
Those are a summary of part of the Greek philosophy. Obviously, the Greek philosophy is much larger, more complex, but those are some broad brushstrokes as to where the tenet is coming from. Prove it to me. Show it to me. It's got to be real, and it's about man in the center of the world, man's body, man's intellect. The concept of a religion was the creation of man. Man creates the concepts of the Greek mythology, of all of their gods, and their very human-like characteristics, because man is at the center, and man is worshipped at that center. Man's intellect, man's physical body. And the Jewish belief, continuing in number two, is the opposed in principle to the Greek philosophers and their thinking. Our belief that God alone created the world through absolute nothingness, all of these things means that God, not forces of nature, continually directs the world and everything in it. We, the Jewish people, the Torah, are the primary causative factors. In the next paragraph, there's nothing haphazard. There's no natural framework. This point is a point to be stressed. At the core of their battle, the Greeks believed in wisdom. They had no problem with wisdom. They were one of the wisest and most technologically advanced, sociologically advanced. They were advancing every element of the world forward, but it was putting man at the center. Man's ability to think, man's ability to reason, man's ability to create, but there can't be a concept of the divine, and nature, therefore, has a major role in their system as the driving force. There's just a natural world which we need to understand, and it functions with its rules, and it is what it is. You can't touch that. Which is why, and again, we're just briefly touching on this point, but when the Jews fight that battle against the Hellenists, against the Jews who wanted to assimilate, who wanted to adopt that culture, who wanted to adopt that worldview, at the core of that worldview is the concept of God is at the center. That's what this battle is about. Is it about mankind being in the center and nature and man understanding nature but simply playing by the rules of nature? Or is God as a creator at the center, and therefore the Torah not being just another book of wisdom but a divine system and all that comes along with that? And therefore, just to conclude this, and we'll wrap this all up with that, when the Jews win and they fight back and they take back the temple, it is only appropriate for the fact that they risked their lives for a worldview. It wasn't just risk their lives so that they should control their own taxes and have their own government. They literally risked their lives, lost their lives, fought a battle for a worldview that put God in the center, and part of that battle was what we would call, what do we do with nature? Where does it fit? Nature's there, but is it there because it is a power unto itself, or is it simply the tool that God used to create the world around us, and He works with that and changes it whenever He feels like it? That battle, it was only appropriate that when the Jews enter into the temple and they light their menorah, which symbolizes the power of the Torah, that they should use only the purest of oils, which, as we mentioned, the Greeks specifically came to defile it. Why would the Greeks specifically attempt to defile the oil? It wasn't just by chance when we read the opening passage. Why did they go after it? Because they don't... What does it mean it's defiled? I'm looking at oil here. There's an entire passage in the Gemara, many, many passages that discuss the following concepts. You have oil, or you have food, say you're a priest, you're a Kohen, and you have your food that you have to eat in a state of purity. And I'm a Jew I don't like you, and I want to do damage to your property, but I'm not so base that I'm going to go and actually destroy your house. I don't want to cause that kind of damage, but I want to do some damage. You know what I do? I take a dead rodent, and I touch it so that I become tame, and then I go over, I wash my hands, they're all clean, soap and water, but I'm tame now. And I go over to your big vat of grain, and I put my hands in it. And now all of your grain became ritually impure, and you, the Kohen, can't eat it. So the Kohen takes me to court and says, you damaged all my stuff, you owe me money. I say, your stuff is perfect, look at it. Nothing changed. It's exactly the way it was before. Do I owe him any money or not? So, well,
So this is, how do you look at that? If you look at the world from a purely physical perspective, what has happened to the grain? Nothing. Well, if you look at the world from a spiritual perspective, what has happened to it? Everything. It's ruined. But you have to have a spiritual set of eyeglasses to see that. So the Greeks go and they try to defile everything. It's cutting to the core of, like, you Jews, you think this makes a difference. So they go around, you know, like, touching everything, because to the Jews, it's like, and so they're like, it's the same oil. Because it's the point of attack that the world is deeper than it appears. That there's the physical world that we see, and then there's an entire realm that you can't see with your eyes, but we have an entire body of law that deals with extensively. Do you know what the punishment is for a Jew who walks into the temple in a state of ritual impurity? Death! So, same person, same spiritual person, I'm a righteous person, I observe all the laws, but if you went in the day after attending the funeral, punishable by death. Because we see the world far deeper than what meets the eye. It's one perspective. And the Greeks didn't and don't. That's part of the Western civilization which we still live in. We live on two planes. The world we see and the world that we cannot see. And therefore when the Jews come back into the temple, it's specifically on that a miracle has to take place. Not because they needed it, because they would have lit the impure oil, because the halakha would have allowed for it at the time. But what an appropriate show, as the Jews come in and they find one flask, that Hashem should do what for them as they defeated the Greeks? Change the laws of nature. Laws of nature don't apply in this battle. That's what you were fighting for. And therefore, since that's what you were fighting for, not because it was necessary, but because it was a show of now we're back together. You've thrown them out, and therefore there is a miracle specifically with the oil and the menorah, which has all these different connotations in Jewish thought of representing the light of Torah. You have that specific miracle, and what's the purpose bringing it all together of the miracle of the oil? Only to point out the miracle of the war that you just went through. And therefore, and that's what we do throughout all of our history. Throughout all Jewish history, we make a big deal about the oil, and that's what's perpetuated this yontif, because that's about the menorah, it's about lighting candles. Because that's how we function as human beings. You need to do something, but what the doing is really only there to allow you to remember and remind yourself about what it's really about. And what it's really about is the war, and that's what it's all about in our lives. Taking the open, revealed miracles that we can experience, and allowing it to impact our understanding of the hidden miracles that we don't necessarily attribute to being miraculous, but are miraculous indeed. And it's through the open ones and the ones that we get our hands busy with, that's a constant reminder to that. And that's what we take out of the answers of Hanukkah, that through that miracle of oil is a reminder that everything in our lives are all miraculous, and the battle that we won over seeing much more than meets the eye, the reality of the spiritual world that we live in, that doesn't fit into the worlds of nature, that's beyond and above the laws of nature, through our light of the Torah that we have. I wish you all a lichtige, enlightened Hanukkah.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.